Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I am your host, S.E. Fleenor, and I'm here today with your other host.
My name is Sarah Century, as longtime listeners will know.
Longtime listener. I thought you were going to say you were a longtime listener, and I was like, that is technically correct, but also you're mostly a host.
I'm going to say that I've listened to this podcast perhaps more than anybody else. I am our biggest fan. Yes, all of those clicks, all of those listens, all of those follows on Twitter.
I'm downloading us on every electronic I have.
Yes.
Not actually, but I probably should do that.
Yes.
Get those downloads up by 5 every week. And we are so pumped because today we have a very special guest, Megan Cubed. Hi, Megan.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure, our journey to get to this point.
Yeah. Yes. You have the honor, the great honor of being one of our most rescheduled technical issues happened the whole time. Yes, I think the other one was Stan Stanley.
Oh my God, that's right.
Stan. Who it was like, I just plain forgot like 3 times in a row. But then like we had the conversation and it was like truly one of our best interviews ever. So bar pretty high.
All right. Well, I'll bear that in mind and I'll try to live up to all hype.
Dazzle, you're gonna dazzle. It turned into like an old-timey Hollywood producer there for about 30 seconds, but I'm back now.
Given the old razzle-dazzle.
We are into razzle-dazzle here at Bitches on Comics.
I'm trying to think because the way that I believe I discovered your work was by following you on Twitter, and on Twitter you are a vocal proponent of your work. You talk about it probably more than most of the people that I follow talk about their work, but I think that this is awesome because I'm constantly seeing artists do this thing where they go like, oh, I'm sorry to like be promoting, or like, sorry to self-promote, or like, I'm sorry, I didn't, you know, it's like there's always like an apology or like a prerequisite or something. And I'm just like, you don't have to apologize for this. This is like literally part of what you do. Like, it's okay. So I take a lot of inspiration. I know I've seen the comments. Like, I know a lot of people take inspiration from that. So And then I remember following you on Patreon before the great Patreon culling that had to happen whenever I had no more money.
Yes.
But it was really great to follow you because you had a lot of great exclusive content. And that's still going, right? The Patreon?
The Patreon, unfortunately, bit the dust in February of this year. Because I post things that Patreon doesn't enjoy, namely things of a monstrously sensual nature. And their payment processors don't like that too much. I had a few posts threatened and I was like, you know what? We're going to move to the old newsletter, take it from behind a paywall and just bring my goodness to, the good people of Earth for free. And I currently post everything, like short stories, snippets, et cetera, et cetera, on my newsletter, which is makingcubed.substack.com. I will probably eventually move to button down because of Substack's nefarious dealings. But for now, that's where you can find all of my promotional work, upcoming projects, short stories, and that sort of thing. So I do appreciate the shout out for my relentless hustle on the internet, my unyielding hustle.
Yes. That is, honestly, it's so admirable to me because I've always been this way too. Like, I'm a poor person, so I can't just be hobbying my art. Like, I really do need to sell it. And like, I need to, it's like, I haven't pushed this envelope. And I don't think you have either, where it's like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to like do this work that I don't agree with just to make ends meet or anything like that. But on the other hand, it's a matter of always trying to figure it out, right? Yeah, so that's how it is for me as well. And I think a lot of people appreciate it. I think it gets people hype about your characters, honestly.
Yeah, I'm of the sort of philosophy that like you have to be your own fandom because literally no one else will do it for you, especially as like a small creator. I'm super indie. I started publishing about, 10 years ago. I think it was about 9, 10 years ago. And it was all like super small press indie stuff, and my attempts at getting an agent and a publisher, et cetera, never quite fanned out. So I'm like a, you know, one person show. And even back when I was publishing with like other small presses, like I was a one person show, which is just the nature of publishing. You know, that's just the less budget you have, the smaller the operation, the more it relies on the author. So those first few years, like it took me a long time to get to this point. The first few years, I was very like shy and not exactly outspoken on social media. You know, I had like my bouts with like self-doubt, like, am I doing the right thing? Am I a good enough author? Do I deserve a spot? You know, that usual sort of like background track of self-defeating stuff. But I learned early on that no one else is going to stand up for you. No one else is going to rep you. And if you want people to care about your work, you have to talk about it like you care about it and give people a reason to care. And like I said, that's why I'm such a firm believer in like hyping my own work and to kind of like lean on the idea of like fandom. Like I did come from like a fandom background. Like I learned to write, you know, it's such a cliche at this point, but you know, I learned to write through fan fiction and I guess inserting myself in so many words into communities that, you know, run different franchises and like Star Trek and Supernatural and Pacific Rim and stuff like that. So I kind of cut my teeth that way and learned to sort of promote better that way. And yeah, I mean, of course, when you're working with a pre-existing fandom, there's a lot of built-in hype for, you know, it's like if you're falling in line with something that people or a read on the characters that people like that'll help, whatever. If you're a good writer, that helps. But I think beginning there and seeing what works and within fandoms kind of helped me as I moved into like my own marketing team, you know, how to talk to people within fandoms and how to sort of approach things, you know, in a way that people who, you know, enjoy media and enjoy talking about media and enjoy talking about their feelings about media are gonna, you know, what they can expect from you and what kind of emotional investment you've already made and why that they should also make an emotional investment. So yeah, it is feelings-based marketing. Vibes-based marketing. I believe in that strategy a lot. But yeah, like I said, when I started off publishing 10 years ago, I wasn't so good at it, but it's just takes time, takes dedication, takes an unabashed desire to talk about your own characters and how cute they are on the internet, which, you know, which I do a lot of. So
yeah. And what else I was gonna say is that we're in this world of the constantly changing platform too, right? Mm-hmm. Whenever it comes to independent creators, because I think for a really long time it was like, if you self-publish, you have to print a zine or something. There weren't really a lot of options. Like, mm-hmm. It was just print. So we only had, you know, so many ways that could pan out. And now it's like almost every creator who does independent work that I know of has to with the caveat, every queer creator I know that does work, you know, even remotely sexually explicit or like, mm-hmm. you know, even remotely queer, really, there's like a constant need of changing platforms. Be that I have to leave Patreon because of the credit card companies or like, mm-hmm. I can't do this fan fiction anymore because like I got a cease and desist or like, mm-hmm. you know, any number of things. And so I think that you mentioning here that like, hey, I'm on Substack now, you know, you're probably going to have to check on that, you know, like it might not be the way, you know, like here in a few months. I think that actually speaks to a much wider issue, right? Where it's just like something that a lot of people don't give independent artists credit for in the internet age is that we have to keep leaping from platform to platform. Even just social media, I started on Facebook. I haven't had a Facebook in like 7 years, you know, it's like now I'm on this other thing and like all of that. So even from a promotional stance, you like lose massive amounts of followers, gain massive amounts of followers. And it's just kind of hard to do, you know, there's not like necessarily a super consistent timeline around it. And so I was just wondering, has that been something that you've grappled with? Because it sounds like you have. And then also, is that something that you consider to be an ongoing challenge in a way that is getting worse? Or do you just think it's been kind of this way this whole time?
I feel like it is getting worse because of the nature of, we'll just say, certain lobbying groups and the single hold that it has on payment processors and banking and censorship on social media platforms and places like Tumblr, you know, that are like, you know, you're lulled into this, like, as a creator, like, come here, you can be yourself, you can talk about your work, you can connect to people. And then it's like, yeah, but if you like are too spicy or like mention a titty, then it like, it's a no go, it's over, you know? And then Patreon, that's why I was on Patreon from 2018 to earlier this year for that exact reason, that they just decided to roll blatantly queer content, blatantly sexual content. You know, I consider myself a, what I call a monstrous romance author, you know, all a sex is present, all my work. And I posted several scenes and snippets and short stories on Patreon, and it did not go well. So a lot of queer creators face lobbying pressures from various like anti-LGBTQ groups and religious groups and all that. It's happening on social media. It's happening on places like, it's happened on Tumblr. It's been happening on Patreon, to just kind of roll all broadly sex, yes, especially, you know, for sex workers who are constantly at risk of being like nuked off the internet. But anyone who makes risque or sensual or like just explicitly sexual work, and especially explicitly queer sexual work, a lot of it in my own experience is that it gets rolled into various forms of criminal activity or perpetuating harm. Like, I used to get threats on my Patreon posts that were just even like consensual sex between like adult characters, enjoy each other's company, let's say, you know, everyone's just consenting enthusiastically, and that was still rolled into potentially, you know, violent or criminal activity and blah, blah, blah. So, yeah. And you're seeing that crackdown on Twitter, which is where I don't even post anything. I just talk about my artwork, and links get suppressed, things sort of disappear, and you're like, okay, here we are. It is getting worse, but at the same time, the public attention is turning the tide a bit, because now people are aware of these things, are talking about, you have a lot of, I mean, sex workers have been very vocal about the problems that they face on the internet and have been organizing. Obviously, like recently we had the whole dust up with OnlyFans, and the only reason that the media attention has been on how it negatively impacts sex workers is because sex workers have been working behind the scenes and organizing for months and years, you know, to try to turn the tide in public opinion. So when I talk about these things, it's like, yes, I create, you know, queer artwork or, you know, queer art, queer content, whatever you really want to call it, that is romantic in nature, that is boundary pushing in nature, because my characters, my romantic heroes and all that are typically monsters, you know, some more monstrous than others. You know, I'm a queer person who writes sexual, sensual work about queer characters and queer monsters. So, you know, I am subject to these pressures and these worries and these fears. I also understand that, like, I'm still not getting it as bad as like a full service sex worker or a cam girl or anything like that. You know, like, they are taking the beating. The best I can do is just try to talk about it in a semi-intelligent way when I'm screaming on the internet and hopefully bring other people who are in the same boat as me to that like conversation. Cause it's like, yes, it affects them. You don't see that just yet, or you're not seeing much of it, but it's coming.
100%. I was going to note that it's such an ongoing thing. Like, I do work for Adweek, so I end up looking at a ton of advertising, and there's whole campaigns that are people being like, hey, Instagram, like, why did you shut down my business account for 2 weeks? Like, we already can't advertise. We already can't do this or that. And it'll be something like sex toys, you know, like it'll be something that, like, a picture of a sex toy on a bed, and people will get their accounts just shut down. So there's been a lot of people campaigning around it. And that's definitely always has been very much led by, you know, sex workers for the most part, from what I can tell, because it's like so often on the front lines for so many things that it's just like truly unfair in a lot of ways. But then it's also like, yeah, years ago, whenever sex workers were like, hey, gay people, you know, like, they're accepting you, but this nope kink at pride conversation is cropping up a lot, isn't it? You know, and like all of that kind of stuff where it's like, maybe just look at this with like a slightly more discerning eye, I guess, because I think a lot of times people will go, oh, well, we won this fight, or like, this is over. And then it's like, as usual, right? They don't notice until it's like the knock is on the door or something like that. But yeah, I think it is a much larger conversation, right?
Yeah, and it's one of those things where the knock on the door doesn't always, you know, read as a threat. You're like, oh, we're just, you know, we're just worried about what's the one I've heard. Setting a good example, you know, like I've had some really like uncomfortable experiences on the old social media with people who are like, oh, you know, you write these things, you know, but like you're not setting a good example. It's like, for who I write,
like whose kids am I raising right now? Because I didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. Like I don't write YA, you know, like this is all for adults.
This is an excellent example for monsters and people who want to fuck them.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I try to provide positive representation for monster fuckers. And, you know, that's my primary concern. You know, like all the Cash Leroys of the world who just really want to date a vampire. Like, I really just try to hold it down for them. But yeah, you know, it's like, you know, you need to be a positive example. And I'm like, I write romance for adults about adults. And it's only marketed to adults. No one, I block minors when I see them on the wild. Like, what more do you want from me? You know, I am constantly telling people I do not write YA. Do not put me on YA lists. Like, I've had this problem where I'm like, please don't put me on a news roundup next to like middle grade and YA books. Like, do you see what I write?
Isn't that a big part of like what a lot of queer creators are going through right now, though, where it's like the only things that anybody can get published are like YA?
And yeah. So
it's like coming of age YA stories is like it, kind of. And I've heard this from a lot of people who are just like, yeah, I mean, maybe I want to write like a horror comic sometime, like, or maybe I want to write something that's like outside of that realm. So I heard that as well. I don't know if that applies to what you were about to say.
Well, no, it's really true. I talked to a lot of different people. I kind of sit at a weird crossroads of like prose fiction. And then like, I know a lot of people in games, a lot of people in comics, and a lot of different places. So like, I definitely see a lot of people in different sort of niches and mediums who are like, you know, God, dude, sometimes, like you said, I just want to do a horror comic. Sometimes I just want to do something gross. Sometimes I just want to just draw titties all day. Why can't I just draw titties all day? You know, because, you know, it's like when it's become this thing, and a lot of it, in my personal experience, I can't speak to like necessarily like comics or film or games or whatever, but like in my personal experience, like once book Twitter became YA Twitter, then it became this whole thing where like every like girl-shaped person on the who writes a book or whatever on the internet now writes YA and is now involved in YA discourse and now has opinions on YA and now caters to teenagers and should make safe spaces for teenagers. And I'm sitting there writing sex scenes about like Gorgon MILF and her girlfriend, and it's like, I don't want to see a teenager. Like, I don't want to think about him. I don't want to acknowledge their existence. They better not be buying my books, because their parents should know what their children are doing. You know, and it just, yeah, there's a lot of overlap. Part of it is like publishing itself, because so much stuff gets, again, if it has like supernatural elements or is, again, written by a woman or has like fantasy elements or whatever, like it tends to get like shelved in YA, even if it's adult fiction. So that's part of it too. That doesn't apply to me so much necessarily because I'm like super indie, but anyone I know with a book deal has complained about that for years. They're like, I write books for adults. They're for adults. They're about adults, whatever. And then like everyone starts screaming at me that like, this isn't YA because this has like blood and war and a titty in it. And it's like, okay, but like I told y'all it was an adult book, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's an overlap of like the marketing issue. There's the overlap of like the social media sort of like perception issue.
Like straight up respectability politics,
yeah,
right? Because
yeah.
It's such a thing of like, I don't think that a lot of straight authors generally have to navigate this. I might be wrong. See, I can be like, well, I've seen mostly, and it's like, well, you mostly follow queer people, so maybe that's why you think that. But like, yeah, once again, it's like, it's okay, but I never want to see it still in a weird way.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's fine if you don't show it to me. And it's like, well, don't follow me on Twitter because I'm going to show it to you. But I can't say for sure. I'm outside of some of those conversations, but I definitely get the impression that you're, if you're like an open queer person or you write a lot of queer characters And whether or not you are doing super adult or mature or like, you know, explicit work of any kind, like the expectations for you to be presentable and PG-13 and safe for work are, at least like in the romance space that I've personally seen, obviously you will always have pearl-clutching fundy moms who are like, oh no, a lady can't experience an orgasm. These books are for the devil. I mean, you always have that, like, following around romance writers. You've had it for decades and you will have it probably until the, you know, death of the universe. But in my personal experience and the conversations that I'm having with, you know, queer creators of all types, of all genres and niches and mediums, you know, both indie and even like, you know, traditionally published or whatever, is that like, yeah, the respectability politics are crushing. Because you're supposed to be neat, clean, tidy, a consummate role model for teens, and you're supposed to usher in a new age for queer youth and acceptance. And it's like, nah, man, sometimes you just want to write a vampire.
And yeah, I can't do it. Or like a bisexual person who makes bad choices. Like, yes. Ooh, what a monster I am. Yeah, no, I hear you on that. And I think there's another dimension here that you've both sort of danced near but haven't, like, addressed head on, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that so often the queer stories that do well in publishing are written by straight people. And if queer people want to write narratives that do well, and I mean, you know, make money, I've heard a lot of queer authors who are established say, yeah, I wrote a straight book. I wrote a straight book so that I could make a bestseller list. I wrote a straight book so that I could make money and show them that I could make money. So now I can write other books. And it's, you know, that's, those people are also in an echelon of publishing that is a rarity in itself. So what they're facing is a particular kind of oppression, but it's part of this bigger conversation that we're having around what does it mean to be a queer creator in an environment that wants to put you into little boxes that, like Sarah said, not all authors are having to put themselves in, you know, mm-hmm. like as queer people, we must conform in ways that, you know, straight people don't have to. And, you know, especially this set white men, you know, like, they sure get to write a lot of interesting stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And like, that is true too. The work that is published and is promoted, like, obviously you have a lot of like the YA space too. You have a lot of like breakout, like queer and trans authors, you know, who are marketed and who do well, and, you know, people support them and they win awards and make a lot of money. And that's great. But there are a lot of people who are closeted because the double-edged sword of like, yes, you can be this new fresh queer voice, but then like, then you will also be a target because, you know, you have the marketing problem, the fandom problem of the expectations of purity and et cetera, respectability, you know. And then of course, if you don't disclose, then if you happen to write, like you said, a bisexual person who makes mistakes or has like a bad time or gives bad vibes or whatever, you know, then it's like, well, then here's this horrible, horrible straight person who's writing this horrible representation. And if they want any quarter in the public discourse, then they need to out themselves immediately, regardless of whether or not they are out anywhere in their lives or they ever chose or ever like planned to out themselves in their own career. So yeah, it's a nasty time to be alive.
Well, and it makes sense that you, and it sounds like out of necessity, so I don't want to make it too simplistic, but it makes sense that you've pivoted into this indie direction. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't think our conversation would go here, but I'm having the best time hearing you talk about this. And I was wondering if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit more for our audience. I think we have a lot of listeners who are creatives in some sense or another. How do you know it's the right time to switch toward a more independent or self-publishing route? And what do you think are some of the key things they need to know as they do so?
For me personally, like I said at the top of the show, like I did the whole like indie swell press thing for a really long time. I published two books that way. It just wasn't a good world. Wasn't something I was like happy with. I met some good people on the way, but it's a tough world. For me, it was the lack of creative and marketing control, I guess, if that makes sense. It's kind of like, you know, I have a very specific vision for like my work and how I promote myself and how I talk about these things. With the last book that I published, I did the queried editors and queried agents and did the whole thing. I did pitch wars and I've been a bunch of things for a while and got some really good feedback and then got some really baffling feedback. But what I came up against for me personally was that my work falls between all the cracks, right? Or like a marketing checklist, you know, it didn't fall into any neat category. And the work that I do, like I said, is like, I call it monstrous romance. It's a blend of like horror and romance. It's like, super, you know, paranormal romance, but with, you know, I think maybe more themes than, you know, your sort of like average, or I think what people think of like a page turner romance, you know. So there's a lot of horror elements. There's a lot of, at least my books, like I try to work in social critique and those sort of things. So when I pitched it as like sci-fi fantasy horror kind of, it didn't hit like the word count for what was acceptable for an adult fiction book. My word count was too low. You know, it's like, yeah, the themes are great. The characters are great. It's really voicey. It's just like, yeah, we can't sell this to adults. You can either tack on 20 or 30,000 more words and some other elements and maybe tone the sex stuff down a little. We'll see. And then maybe we can try it again. And I was just like, that's not going to work. So when I pitched it to like romance editors and publishers, it was like, this is all great, but like there's too much plot and there are too many themes and it doesn't follow like the neat A to B like romance storyline. And so it was like, okay, it's not adult enough for adults and is too much book for romance. And I'm not trying to like slander romance, obviously. It was just an interesting like note to get where it's like, there's too much plot here. And I'm like, okay. So like for me, it was just like, I fell in between the cracks of so many genres. So that was like, okay, I have to put this out myself. You know, I have plans for like the Southern Gothic series, which is like the little child who lives in my brain. And I think about it every day is like going to be 7 or 8 books. You know, that's my plan. That's what I have like accounted for in my ever-growing list or a pile of, you know, notebooks that I write all of my books in. But like, no one is going to give me an 8-book deal. No one is going to do that. No one is going to even give me a 3-book deal. They're like, either this works or it doesn't. So the sort of like the lack of control over like the content of my work, if I wanted to sell it, you know, because if I wanted to pitch this book to publishers, it was like, oh, we're going to have to make all these changes. I'm like, that's not possible. To me, because I'm like, and I would have written that book, you know, and I didn't. I wrote this book instead. So, like I said, for me, the impetus of it was just that I fell between so many cracks that I couldn't come out of it and still like attempt to have a book deal or attempt to, you know, go with a small press because I just did not hit any of those like checklists. And like I said before about them, that's creative control, you know, that overarching control, like where I want the story to go, the elements of the story. You know, obviously I love horror, I love romance. Those things are like married in these books. And that was going to be a no-go. It had to fall on one side or the other. And then again, in terms of marketing, it was like I said before, about being a good role model, you know, that sort of thing. You're a little outspoken on social media, you know, that sort of thing. So it was just, there was a lot of reasons where I'm like, I'm not going to tone my work down. I'm not going to tone myself down. I've been writing and publishing for so long that it's like, you know, I know I'm good at it and I know that people respond to my work. So I can rewrite the book and rewrite the book and rewrite the book and keep pitching to agents and keep pitching to editors and stuff. I was like, or I could just put out the book that I have, you know, because it's like, I believe in it. I'd had a lot of success with like the short stories I had released around the universe of the book for the last, you know, 3 years or so. And it's like, people already love these characters. You know, they already love the world that I've built. You know, they followed me on Patreon. They followed my newsletter. You know, they've read the stuff that I've published, you know, myself. So I was like, I can sit here and try to force this book into any number of molds, really, and try to get it published. Or, you know, I can just do it myself and give it to the audience that's already there. That was my decision. I think everyone kind of comes to that point in their own way. Be it the kind of work that they write, how fast they write, because that's another issue too, is that like mainstream publishing, traditional publishing wants you to like write like 3 books a year, 4 books a year. And depending on your genre, you know, it is a brutal breakneck pace that you have to, you know, keep up with. And I'm like, I'm not writing fast enough in any genre that I was going to try to like slot myself into to keep up with that kind of workload. Cause, you know, obviously I have a day job, otherwise I couldn't fund any of this stuff, but you know, your health and your life work balance figures into the decision for me anyway, you know, how much work you can even reasonably accomplish in a year. Some people can write at a breakneck speed and that's great. You know, God bless them, but that's not me. So yeah, like I said, work life balance creative control, marketing control. There's the content. There's just a lot that kind of plays into it. I think everyone reaches that point in their own time. But if you really believe in what you're doing and you've already built up an audience, even a fairly small one, it's getting cheaper and easier all the time to put your work out by yourself. Or even if you worked with like small publishing co-ops crop up all the time. I know a couple of people who run some. And yeah, I mean, I am a firm believer that like you will release the work how it should be released, however long it takes. Now, if you're the kind of person who absolutely has to have a traditional publishing book deal, then work on that. And if you're like me and you don't, then don't stress out over it because, you know, life finds a way and so do books. So
Yeah. I was thinking too that some of the best advice I ever got was just essentially around just not being too precious about stuff and being kind of like, yeah, everything has the audience that it has. So I think a lot of times I used to be a musician. And so you would play shows and some of them there'd be a lot of people and some of them there wouldn't be that many people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people would have to have like a whole here's why maybe or something, you know, and mm-hmm. I just always felt like it was a little rude to the audience that did show up because it's like, well, there were still people here. So one of my friends once said something along the lines of every show has the audience that was meant to be there because you can't really negotiate with it once it's said and done. Right. So yeah. I always thought that that was a really important thing because I do think a lot of people will kind of psych themselves out and be like, well, nobody cares or like not enough people care. And it's just like, well, why don't you stop worrying about that? Let people care if they're going to, you know, like I think that whenever you say something like, well, nobody cares, then it's mm-hmm. just like that can't help but be a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? I was picking up some themes of that and just kind of thinking about how all of the best advice I've ever gotten, regardless of anything, like regardless of like if tomorrow I was going to sign a big old book deal or something like that and get a bunch of money, it would have to be the same idea of, well, don't get too precious about yourself because God knows what's going to happen after that, right? So I don't know. I was wondering if does that ring true to you as well?
No, definitely. Because yeah, like you said, like you can do the very best you can every single time and you will plateau at the exact amount of readers. You know what I mean? Like that's as many people who are going to read that book. And you can do whatever harebrained scheme you come up with to promote that book. And it's going to reach that many people, you know? And for me, it's like, I know that I'm a niche writer. I know that I've carved out a readership, like by hook or by crook, you know, during my time through different like things that I've done. And the way that I kind of frame my philosophy is that you're either on the bus, you know, get on the bus or get run over. Like, that's it. Like we're going. I'm going. No one has figured out a way to stop me. Publishing tried not to give me a book deal. It didn't work because I just decided to publish the book myself. And, you know, and that's kind of just my sort of philosophy on that. It's like, I'm going to do this one way or the other. You can either get on board or not. And that's kind of just how you have to look at it, you know. And then everything when it comes to releasing your work is kind of a negotiation on like of your own terms as well, because yeah, you could be like, I absolutely have to have a print run and I have to sell copies at bookstores and I have to do all this stuff. It's like, okay, but if you're not sure if you've built an audience, you can just release an ebook first and, you know, make some of that money back that you spent on editing or your cover or, you know, whatever, or any sort of like marketing plan that you might have, you know, or ads you've taken out, you know, whatever you spent in the production and marketing process. If you release it as an ebook, get some of that money back, and then you can put that towards doing a little print run. If you're worried that you're going to end up with a stack of unsold books, then just do ebooks, just do PDFs. If you don't want to mess with Amazon, then just do PDFs and sell them on Gumroad. Like there's so many things that you can do, and you can do super limited runs of things, like, you know, whatever. It's totally fine. And then if you're unhappy with it, you can just delist it, pretend it never happened. So, you know, if pseudonyms exist for a reason, if you ever just want to try something, you know, it's like if you limit yourself to this is what an artist is or this is what an author is, then like, yeah, like you said, don't be precious because then you're never going to get the work out. But then also like a lot of things have started off as ebooks. A lot of my work has started off as it's ebooks only. And then because people really cared about it, like I did a print on demand. So, you know, it just kind of depends on the circumstances, how much time, money, et cetera, you're able to put into something. But then also just kind of letting it go and being like, well, I'm going to do this and it's going to reach its audience. It's going to have the impact that it's going to have. And then I just write the next book and I keep on going. So
I was going to say, whenever you brought this up, was that if some of my, like, whenever I was 20, 25, I was doing a bunch of Persians that were basically just about sad breakups, which
then I
evolved into who I am today, of course, who just writes other sad allegory. But
naturally.
It's a real progression as an artist. You know?
I was like, if a single one of those zines resurfaces, this Sarah Sentry identity is gone. Like, I am becoming a different person. I am changing my name, like, because they're embarrassing.
Yeah.
But like, it's okay for it to be embarrassing in the beginning, right? Nobody starts out great. We act as if, like, there's, you know, the people who are like, oh, this person was only 22 when they wrote this amazing book. And it's like, yeah, but most writers aren't 22 when they write their first amazing book, right? Like,
yeah.
And that writer, like, fizzled out super fast, right? Which is always a threat, you know, I think when you're young and people are just like, you're a genius. It's like, well, you're probably going to believe them and then it's all over for you. But yeah, I don't know. I was kind of thinking about all of that and just like how our paths kind of change over time as well. Yeah. And so I think that independent publishing is something, you know, that nobody should be scoffing at. But I think it also has a huge background whenever you're looking at queer creators who, mm-hmm. because it's like, I mean, our stuff was like illegal for a long old time.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't
oh, yeah.
send it in the mail. So like, it was illegal. If like you were doing queer publications, you had to like deliver them by hand, essentially. And even then you might get arrested for it. Many of the major obscenity trials have been either queer works were in them or, you know, whatever. So I think that there's something to be said, too, just for like the long history of queer creators that have had to self-publish and that we remember them as being these, you know, iconic figures.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, where do we draw the line from like, ah, this person is a trailblazer. Look at everything they did. They published this in a basement and handed it out to people in pamphlets. And this is art now, you know, this is an historical document. And then now it's like, oh, well, this is just self-published trash. And it's like, but like, you can't say that it's self-published trash when there are still massive structural barriers to people attempting to have any kind of career and let alone like just feed themselves based on their own creative work. And yeah, there's a certain sense of just like, kind of just saying, fuck it. And honoring that sort of that past, you know, the fact that like I always joke about my own work is just being like pulp. It's pulp fiction. I follow a lot of like social media accounts that like document pulp novels, especially like lesbian pulp novels and go through the history of all of them. And it's super interesting stuff when you look at the censorship of the day and how people managed to skirt it through pseudonyms and deploying certain tropes to make sure that like, you know, that's where like barrier gaze kind of came from, because they could not have a happy ending. They could have, you could tell a really fascinating, compelling story, but then someone had to die or go back to their husband or whatever.
Right. And it was like by, you know, like, hey, we're really cheap, like supposedly lowbrow entertainment, so don't worry about this too much, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so like I'm interested in the history of like pulp fiction and like, you know, pulp novels and in like, you know, cheapo like horror and like weird comics from like, you know, back in the day, you know, before the Comics Code Authority and all that stuff, you know. And I look back on that stuff very fondly, like I'm very deeply interested in that stuff and reverent of that stuff. And I consider that stuff like peer to me. I consider myself closer to the cheapo lesbian, my wife was a teenage MILF or whatever, you know, novel from 1965 than like a best-selling romance novel or horror novel out today. Like, I think that is more of like what I'm setting out to do and closer to what I can feasibly accomplish, you know, dealing with censorship and respectability and whatever of my own day and of my own daily life on the internet, you know? So yeah, I think it's good to sort of like look back on history with like some perspective. Like, yeah, I'm not having to like turn this out as like a pamphlet and share it and like in a club. You know, I'm doing pretty good. I can sell it on Amazon at least for this week at time of recording. Next week we'll see, but you know, they threaten me sometimes. But yeah, you know, I think it's good to look back on that stuff with reverence and know the circumstances of its publication and know the stories of the people who made it and understand that, you know, You're not that far off. You know, don't get precious. You ain't special.
You want to see us eat meals, survive, thrive in the world, come back with the podcast, be cool all the time, make money, get cars. I don't know. At that point, I was just buy new shoes, get a pony, invest in Bitcoin.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and argue with that last one. But otherwise, I am there with you.
Okay, I'm not going to invest in Bitcoin. But hey, if you want to see us, you know, be financially soluble, please join us on Patreon at patreon.com/bitchesoncomics. We have tons of content there. We have, I think it's like 100 back episodes. So those are things that range from talking about individual independent comics that we like, as, you know, each of us on our own together, to talking about Wynonna Earp, why we loved it so much. Yes, we had a bonus episode about it before we had a mainstream episode about it. Who could say why? Why not? We have our cage match episodes, which are just so wild. We just compare two Nicolas Cage films and then decide which is cagier. And it's probably the highlight of my life, if I'm being honest. We also have our Intoxicated Comics special that we do, where we get a little bit woohoo and then talk about weird comics. Sometimes we have a great time and sometimes we're like, what have we done? And either way, it's pretty funny. We also have exclusive interviews with smaller creators, all kinds of different stuff. We basically use our Patreon as an opportunity to put more good comics info out there. Oh my goodness, a very pretty bird just landed outside my window.
Oh, in this spot, we got to talk about this bird. All right, let's get through it.
This bird has a little red head. Oh, it flew away. Beautiful little bird. Thank you, bird. So yeah, you know, come join us on Patreon so I can look at more birds. We're at patreon.com/bitchesoncomics. You got to spell it out. You can't go to patreon.com and then search us because we're, I don't know, bitches. We curse too much. We're some they're like, you sound like some real bitches. So we're not going to make you searchable. And we were like, fair.
Fair.
Harsh, but fair.
Yeah, I deserve that. I deserve it.
Speaking of fuck it, let's talk about your books.
Let's
talk about this incredible world you've created. Why don't you give us our listeners just sort of a high level, what's the world? Tell us about Cash and Dorian. Very exciting stuff. I want to hear it all.
All right. So the Southern Gothic series got its start as a short story in the romance comics and prose anthology organized by Alex DeCampi, Twisted Romance. And I was in the first issue with some really, like, incredibly talented people. That whole anthology series is really good.
I have it right on my bookshelf. It's literally, like, looking right back at me right now. So
it's like, oh, there it is. It's where it all began. I originally had this idea for a monster hunting sort of romance. You know, I had spent many years and written many things about supernatural and had some very strong feelings about the handling of one Dean Winchester and one Castiel.
Huh. I wonder why.
Yeah. It's funny.
I could go into a rage right now.
And I'd been like on the outskirts of that fandom, but I'd written a few interesting things. And I had fallen out of my long infatuation with it. And then, as I always do when I get mad at things, I go, fuck it. I'm going to file the serial numbers off this bitch and I'm going to write my own, which is how I've started every single like novel or story I've ever written. I get mad at something and I'm like, nope, we're going to do it my way.
Which is funny, though, because isn't that what people always say to like queer creators is be like, well, then create your own. If there isn't that, then like, why are you bothering Marvel? Just create your own. And then like you do it.
And
and now I have nothing to say.
Yeah, exactly. The short story came about because I had been enamored with like monster hunting fiction for a really long time. I have been like a lifelong fan, basically, of like Vampire Hunter D. And just a lot of stories in that vein, especially from like anime and video games like Castlevania. I love vampire hunting stories. I love monster hunting fiction in general. And having been burned and feeling very butthurt about the state of Supernatural, which had been my favorite show for a really long time, I knew an annoying amount of lore written an annoying amount of things that can still be found on Archive of Our Own and LiveJournal if you know where to look. And I was just like, I want to write a monster hunting story for like my whole life, my trope of tropes. And it was true of Supernatural. It's true of like my freaking obsession with the Neon Genesis Evangelion is that like I love the idea of a otherworldly or supernatural character of some kind who just comes down from on high or from the cave or like whatever, wherever they happen to come from, and just loves a deeply flawed and stupid human with all of their heart.
That fucking Dean.
Fucking Dean, man. Like,
and that's all he needs, right? That's all he needs. What he needs is to let himself be loved by Castiel. Exactly. I have very strong feelings. I know we both do.
Yes. I wrote a whole ass book about it. So a whole ass book and about 30 short stories. So let me tell you. So that's like my favorite trope. That's my favorite like romance trope. And I have very strong feelings about like paranormal romance because of that, because it's like, oh, like that's fine, but like, this over here is my favorite. I love the idea of like something otherworldly, eerie, supernatural, something non-human that just loves a stupid, broken human. And despite all warning signs, you know, and I was like, I just want to do something with that. And so when Alex approached me for the anthology, she was just like, yes, you're writing something, right? And I'm like, all I have is a loose idea for a vampire who's very, very bad at being a vampire and who hangs out with a monster hunter, and then they hunt monsters together and then they fall in love through hijinks. And she's like, write it. So I did. And it was called Leather and Lace. And the premise of Leather and Lace, both the original short story and the novel, the full length novel that it became, is that it follows the very stupid adventures of a goth dipshit vampire by the name of Dorian Villeneuve, who is just a professional fuck up and tragic backstory, comes from a broken vampire home, has survived by working customer service jobs, low paying jobs, doing sex work, doing all these things just to, you know, stay off the street. And, you know, one day at his stupid job as a bartender at a vampire bar, because all great stories start off at a vampire bar, a hunter, a very attractive hunter from Texas, happens to stroll in and is hunting one of the vampires there who happens to be part of the vampire mob. And Dorian is immediately smitten with who he comes to know as Cash Leroy. And they become immediate friends when Cash gets his ass beat by the said vampire mafia guy. And Dorian has to save him. And, you know, they just develop this instant attraction and also friendship, because Cash is like, oh, a good, kind boy who's indebted to Dorian, you know, who's a monster and didn't have to do that for him. And oh my God, you know, what a kind soul. I will take him under my wing and I'll teach him how to be a monster hunter and all this good sort of like, you know, romantic business. So that's how they meet. That's the germ of the whole series. And both the short story and the book follow Dorian and Cash's misadventures as Dorian gets slightly better over time at hunting monsters under Cash's, you know, tutelage and supervision, and their roommates, their partners. They spend all their time together. They finish each other's sentences and make fun of each other constantly. And, you know, the sort of like the thematic like crux of the whole thing is that Cash's one true singular hobby is that he is obsessed with Stevie Nicks. And he loves karaoke. And all he sings is Stevie Nicks songs in honor of her, who is his favorite. And so they bond over their musical tastes. They bond over, you know, karaoke. They bond over their sordid, like, parental issues and sordid pasts and all that good stuff. And the short story and the novel follow their changing friendship, at which becomes a bit of a moonlighting will they, won't they situation on the case of monstrous, murderous were-deer, which is sort of a callback to Hannibal, one of my other fandom not-so-dirty secrets that is also a public secret if you know where to look for the stories. Huh? And yeah, so it's this romantic rom-com hijinks about, you know, a swaggery Texas monster hunter and his best friend who's a vampire and a dipshit and has an emotional support chihuahua named Dominique. And, you know, their various adventures hunting, you know, murderous weredeer and cannibal school teachers and all this good stuff as their friendship becomes more than that. And then they navigate the trials and tribulations of having a complicated supernatural romance as monster hunters. You know, Cash hunts monsters professionally. Dorian is a monster who now hunts monsters professionally. And let's just say that, like, the in-laws on either sides will not be thrilled when they find out about this. But yeah, that's kind of the overview of the series and the book, because, like I said, it has a very interesting and comics adjacent origin story in the Twisted Romance anthology. So
It's amazing. It's so much fun to read, too. It's got such great pacing and characterization. And I'm disappointed to hear that someone was like, your romance has too much plot. I personally was like, that's part of what makes this so delightful. And so, you know, we get stuck in, because of marketing, we get stuck in genre conversations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, marketing has a stranglehold on publishing, and that's just a fact. Mm-hmm. I'm not even saying anything controversial. These are facts. Mm-hmm. And it's disappointing sometimes that the books that people are really hungry for get buried. Like, I wasn't familiar with your work, and I'm a fan for life. Like, I love this shit. I'm like, give me more Cash and Dorian. Give me Cash and Dorian every day of the goddamn week. And what I was curious about, to whatever degree you're comfortable discussing this, mm-hmm. and if this question isn't appropriate, we can always cut it in post. There's always this conversation about women specifically, and I'm going to put an asterisk there because I know that that's not exactly the whole truth for you, mm-hmm. about women writing men loving men. Mm-hmm. And again, like, I know that you also use they, so I know you have some gender something going on, mm-hmm. which I love, of course, as a non-binary person. But I'm curious how you think about that conversation and how writing Cash and Dorian may or may not be related to your own gender journey.
Well, it's a loaded kind of, like, situation with that, because I'm of the mind that, like, anyone can write anything, right? Like in the larger cosmic sense, like, anyone can tell any story. What stories are uplifted, which are reinforced, which are paid for, which are marketed, you know, those become the very complicated aspects of that, especially when, like, historically speaking, like we were talking about before, so much of, like, MM or whatever they want to call it, like, romance, you know, gay romance is written historically by, like, you know, straight-ish women, you know? So you had a lot of men, queer men, trans mass people, trans men, like, you know, the different sort of, like, variations of people who would want to write these things, but, like, are kind of locked out of the conversation because those are not the kinds of books that are being bought. You know, you have a lot of, like, I don't know, just, like, sort of wish fulfillment that comes with a lot of, like, more standard MM or gay romance or whatever, you know, and men loving men. A lot of tropes, some have, you know, carry more damaging baggage than others. So, you know, and I happen to know a lot of people who are super indie or self-published or whatever, you know, who are men who write these kinds of books and write these kinds of romance, but they've had to, because, like, they've been told by editors and by agents that, like, yeah, this is great, but, like, it doesn't hit the tropes. We're looking more like this over here, which is written by, like, a straight woman, or what we presume to be a straight woman. Like, you know, yeah, pseudonyms exist for a reason, you know. But when most of the names on the covers of these books are not men's names, it's a very loaded sort of conversation. So I write gay romance, I write lesbian romance, I write various permeations of things. But for me personally, I try to come at every story from a place of, like, this is not my story. This is a story. And I'm not trying to speak for anyone else or speak for anyone's experiences or speak to any sort of, like, topical intra-community discussions, you know, like, here's a story, here's the human beings in the story. I'm going to do the best that I can to write humanely and respectfully and get, you know, as many eyes on it as possible before we hit, you know, send to Amazon to make sure that at least people who, I guess, would feel represented by the characters on the page don't feel uncomfortable or tread upon in any way, you know, or fetishized, you know, any of those things, you know, that, like, as long as it reads like a person and a person that who may see themselves in that character feels, or I should say as many people as possible who can see it before I publish, feel comfortable with that character and think that there's something in there that resonates, then like, I think I've done my job. That was very important to me with Cash. I'm not a gay half-Mexican man, so that's well beyond my wheelhouse, you know. I try to get as many eyes on that as possible and talk to as many people and get feedback from the original short story all the way to the novel. And then so when people tell me that, like, ah, I love this character, he really resonates with me, I feel you do a good job with him, that, like, that feels good to me, because it's like, okay, that's the thing that, like, keeps me awake at night. Like, I talk a lot of shit on the internet, as we know, but, like, I never want to hurt anyone intentionally or unintentionally or conjure up baggage. You know, like, I don't want to hurt anybody. Like, I write fun, romantic, very sexy pulp fiction, and I'm not here to, you know, hurt people. So, like, it is important to me as someone who, like, is outside of that sort of world and who understands to some extent, not fully, but the trials and tribulations of trying to publish that work as someone who is the person being represented on the page. You know, like, I understand that a lot of men are locked out of the romance publishing world. And, you know, that's a much broader conversation that I'm not prepared to have, because I'm not in on the marketing meetings and all that stuff. But yeah, so those are the things that I try to do. And when people tell me, oh, I love this character, then, like, okay, woo, I'm not a monster. So I can sleep at night.
Yeah, I was thinking about something along those lines, because there is a lot of times as a lesbian, there's so many portrayals of lesbians and, you know, I'd say bisexual women as well that are just so wild, and it can be really offensive, but I think that it's most offensive when it's just that, right? Like, it's most offensive when it's only that kind of creator, like cis white men telling that story, always a straight guy or whatever. And that's when it really becomes a huge bummer for me, is that there's not alternatives to the text, right? Like, there's nothing else beyond that. I think you were mentioning that, like, a little bit. Yeah, there's times where I think people will be hypercritical towards something, and I'm just like, I don't know, I think that this is just, like, a regular story, and he chose, like, a lesbian character, and it's fine, you know? And, like, honestly, sometimes it's for the best, because this might be one of the only, like, 5 movies this year, you know, that have that representation. So it like, turns into this interesting conversation that's, like, you almost have to take it on a case-by-case basis, but then also, like, the nature of the publishing world is kind of really what makes it difficult to navigate, because so often we all get kind of boiled down to, like, whatever is wanted by the publishing company at that time in a lot of ways, so I don't know.
Yeah, and then especially with Dorian, because to get back to the previous question, I didn't mean to cut myself off, but I did. But one of the notes that I got about Dorian, who is non-binary by the nature that he comes from a vampire culture that does not perceive binary gender or sexualities of any kind. Like, the default state for vampires in this universe is pansexual, gender fluid, and polyamorous. So
my people, it's my people.
Yeah. So in this book, I touch a little more on, like, the sort of, like, the vampire world building in the next one, because the next book is very, like, nitty gritty in, like, vampire culture, because they, like, go back to Devil's Row, you know, Dorian's stomping grounds, and they're on a case of, like, a missing teenage vampire, and there's a lot of, like, all that stuff. So I get into, like, the nitty gritty of, like, how vampire society functions and how families arrange themselves and, you know, and all that kind of stuff in the next book. In the first book, it's very touch and go, because it's like, we are running and gunning, we're having a good time, we have to stop these, you know, cannibal school teachers, we gotta go, and fall in love along the way. The way that I conceive of vampires in this world is very much based on my own sort of internal feelings about gender and gender performance and sexuality, is that, like, I call myself, like, a girl-shaped person. Like, woman doesn't mean anything to me. It's just one of those things. It's like an ill-fitting suit. You know, it's like, it's thrown on you and you're like, okay, whatever. I had a non-binary character previously in a book series that I had planned called The Crashers. I had a character who's going to come to grips with, you know, their gender identity in the second book. The publisher shut down, everything fell into limbo. I put the book out again myself, but then after everything happened, I just kind of, like, lost my taste for that world. So I kind of had a yearning for a while to, like, kind of dig into those ideas in tandem with like my own life stuff, but I'd left that sort of like on the back burner. And then with Dorian, like, you know, he is a non-binary vampire because they're all non-binary. They don't understand binary gender. They don't understand any of these things. They don't exist. So I tend to call him gender queer when I'm talking about him because that feels a little more specific to what he is and what he does. Dorian uses, you know, he, him pronouns, but that's more of like a linguistic residue of vampires learning English because they have their own languages and things that they, you know, people learn through certain systems. But the various vampire languages don't have binary pronouns, gendered pronouns. Everything is their equivalent of they, or they address everyone by their name or direct address or whatever. So the fact that he has he, him pronouns is just like they had to learn English and that's just what they picked up along the way. So he responds to he, you could call him whatever you want. He's going to respond to it. He feels most comfortable presenting as feminine. You know, I joke about him being, you know, a goth dipshit. You know, he's very concerned about like his eyeliner and his mascara and all this stuff and his nails, make sure they're all like perfect. But part of it is like poverty, you know, being able to control his appearance helps him feel control of his life because so little is in his own control. Another part of it is that, like, you know, he feels most comfortable when he feels the most feminine. And in the first book, he never comes out and says it. There's no conversation with Cash about it because Cash is a cis gay man. He's a gay human. You know, he understands enough about vampires to know that he takes Dorian completely at face value because their entire culture has no concept of these things. They all navigate everything very fluidly and, you know, they don't have the same like hangups or concerns or anxieties. Like Dorian is an anxious character, so he will always be anxious about his appearance. But again, that's like that's him controlling something for himself. But you know, I wanted to kind of wrestle with that a little bit in the story where it's like, yeah, Cash is like a very masculine man who dates very masculine men. And then Dorian shows up and it's like, oh no, he's perfect and I love him and he's so beautiful. And I never wanted it to be like the source of a crisis for Cash, that Dorian changes anything about him, you know, and his attraction or his feelings about himself, that like Dorian exists and then Cash exists. And now they exist together and they are attracted to each other for the reasons that they are attracted to each other. You know, they complement each other. They get along really well. You know, they make fun of each other. They have fun together and they happen to be very, very like attracted to each other. And I never, ever wanted that to be like a plot point or like something that makes Cash doubt himself or becomes a teachable moment, you know, because like Dorian exists and Dorian will always exist as this. And it wouldn't occur to him to be self-conscious about those things, that he's not what gender he's performing or what sexuality he's supposed to model. It doesn't mean anything to him because it never meant anything to him culturally. And so then Cash just rolls along with it. And it was just kind of important to me in my own life and on the page just to be like, okay, these are all characters who take each other at face value. We're not going to have a crisis. We're not going to make it a thing. There's going to be no like gay panic. There's nothing, you know, and I kind of want that to be the baseline of the world. And then to sort of head off any criticism, I guess, because I understand that there is a longstanding history of like non-binary or like agender characters or whatever, being aliens or robots or angels or et cetera, et cetera. And like, and I know that it is problematic on like face value for the only non-binary character in the world thus far to be a monster, you know, a literal vampire. But there's like two trans women and two trans humans in book three, and Cash knows them and it's fine. So
also, I feel like as a non-binary person, I think you can do whatever the fuck you want and everybody should back up.
Agreed. But,
okay.
You know. But all so the
I'll
Twitters.
I'll help you fight. Just tag yes. me in. Tag me in next time.
Yeah,
I mean, if you need it, but, mm-hmm. you know. Well, forgive me for any assumptions I made or, you know, I know you use the term woman and I apologize.
No. That's totally fine. It's totally fine.
No
worries.
No. You know, that's why we want to have the pod. We want to talk about these things. And, you know, I think and I can't say for you, but I can say for me, sometimes when I create worlds where someone being non-binary isn't even a conversation or being trans is just a thing that happens. And not always in societies that accept trans people, but sometimes just in trans people who accept one another, it helps me heal. It helps me feel a little bit safer in the world and more like, hey, maybe I can give someone else permission to do the same for themselves and each other, right? Like, we deserve to have non-binary characters, and God damn, there are a few of them.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And that's something that, like, I really think about a lot in the world, because it's a fantasy situation. You know, it's fantasy races, it's fantasy classes. You know, every monster has their own cultural norms and things that are passed down. And those are all, like, super regional. So, like, a vampire in, like, obviously, like, Louisiana, which is, like, where Dorian lives, versus, like, someone in, like, India. Completely different cultural norms and things like that, you know. So, like, same with, like, the werewolves and this shifter and that shifter, you know. Like, they all have different relationships with these ideas, and those ideas are impacted by the regional human cultures that they've been kind of forced to live alongside and assimilate into some degree or another. Obviously, shapeshifters can just completely, you know, merge into human society and be taken as normal at face value. And then you have, like, vampires and other, like, more beastly or monstrous looking sort of creatures who don't have that luxury and have to hide. And then even the hunters themselves are a completely insular class of people, which we get way more into when we meet Cash's family in book two. But, you know, these are, like, very insular, stateless communities, hunting family dynasties, basically, that have their own norms and have their own rules and have their own cultures and all of these things. And they all navigate ideas of like, what is a man? What is a woman? What does any of this mean? Gender, sexuality, et cetera, et cetera. And then within the context of monsters being hunted and not being, like, super, having super high birth rates and being everywhere, they're not like humans. They're always going to be minorities. And then vampires are minorities within minorities, you know, for lots of, like, world building reasons that book two we'll get into some more. And so, you know, they're all basically fantasy classes, and each of them have their own different specific ideas of gender and sexuality. And then because of that, they don't necessarily jive with what we expect from the larger dominant culture. So, like, Cash growing up with, like, trans women who grew up to be hunters alongside him and everything, like, that's totally normal. These are things that just sort of happen. Like, they have their own social pressures and things, but, you know, they take each other at face value. And then Cash takes Dorian at face value, and they're on the margins of society. You know, Dorian is a monster, Cash is a hunter, and then they have this very insular little world together where they don't necessarily, they navigate the stuff with Cash's family, and we will eventually meet Dorian's family, and it'll be a whole thing, I promise.
I promise. What I like to hear.
Yes, that was the big critique of the first book. People were like, I really wanted to know about Dorian's family. I'm like, everyone buckle in. That is the series plot. So I'm not crazy. I name dropped everyone and ran. That's foreshadowing. And there's going to be conversations and negotiations and navigating all that really complicated stuff when it gets to, like, family and vampire culture and hunting culture. But, like, ultimately, like, they don't feel a lot of the pressures that people in other, like, contemporary stories are going to. And I think most of us in our own daily lives feel, because, like, yeah, it's kind of like wish fulfillment escapism, but, like, they are in this little world, in this little bubble, and they are so far removed from everyone else, and they're not going to worry about that. Like, Cash's mom is not going to be happy about Dorian, but it's because he's a vampire and because he's taking her boy. That's why she's going to be upset. It's not about him being a boy vampire or any other kind of his gender expression. Like, that doesn't figure in. It's just the rules that they have to navigate really are not going to be about sex or gender or anything like that. Because I really wanted this to kind of move away from the expectations of certain kinds of violence, let's say, in horror, in more action-heavy genres, in monster hunting fiction itself, getting back to supernatural. Oh boy, there's plenty of those kind of things. So maybe it's wish fulfillment and fantasy in my part, but, like, I like the idea of, like, them all being just, like, queer little weirdos on the fringes of the fringes, just hanging out, having a relationship and all that stuff. And then the rest of it kind of be damned, because they're not going to see it or feel it anyway. And maybe that's just okay. You know, I maybe it's just me giving myself permission to be like, you know, I don't know if that's queer normative or not. It's just sort of a big old fuck you. We're not even going to talk about it. They're just going to exist, and we can all be happy for that. And that was kind of like my marching orders for myself with the story and the idea of representation and queer normativity versus, you know, dealing with queer phobia or transphobia or homophobia, like any of these sorted phobias. Just like you Hell said, yeah. like, yeah, like you said, like creating safe spaces, I guess, and giving myself the permission to have a safe space in this world. Because it is a nasty world. Cannibal school teachers. Nasty yeah, world.
I'm cracking my knuckles and I'm like, gotta get ready to write my Cash and Dorian fanfic. You know? Gotta get ready. This is beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing about how the ideas came together and how you think about queerness and transness in that world. How gender and sexuality appear in the vampire world or don't, which is beautiful. Chef's mm-hmm. kiss. So yeah, I mean, we've been dancing around monster fuckers.
Yes.
Let's talk about monster fuckers. Okay, Cash is both a monster hunter and a monster fucker.
Yes,
he is. I want to hear more about that. And then why do you think queer people and trans people in particular are so drawn to monster fucking, monster fuckers, and monsters?
All right, so Cash is one of those kind of like complicated things because, you know, I originally had the original version of the story had a whole stable of monster ex-boyfriends that I wanted to tackle. But like as the plot, the overarching plot of the series kind of coalesced, it was like, shit, he had so many boyfriends and we whittled down to one that's the most plot relevant. Maybe one day in like some short stories, we'll see the others. But like he had a werewolf biker boyfriend for a long time that I still miss and I want to write more about him. So we'll see about the misadventures of Cassius Leroy, maybe at another time. But Cash is my critique slash response of and to like Dean Winchester. It's pretty clear. The flannel, the Texas accent, the swagger, the little flippy in the front bangs. You know, that's just him. And like I said, I'm enamored with that Cass and Dean like situation. And I wanted to reverse it where you have a human who's just so like impossibly in love with a very stupid and flawed like monster and chases him around and makes him come to karaoke and tries to better him and all that stuff. You know, Cash is the consummate. I can fix him, but like not in a creepy way, like he like in a loving way. For him, he's such a compassionate character, again, because I have strong feelings about the handling of Dean Winchester and the refusal to let him have feelings besides drunk and shooting and pushing everyone away. So my critique is to have someone who just wears their heart on their sleeve to their own detriment and is so emotional and earnest and sincere and everything. And that plays into like the idea of like how he perceives Dorian. It's like, you know, Dorian is just he's so smart and he's so beautiful and he's just so capable. And I love him. And, oh, you know, and it seems like it would be a like conflict of interest to both hunt monsters, but then also date monsters. But in this sort of world, like, and again, book two and book three, we're going to get into more of that. Monsters are people too. He has to work alongside monsters within the law enforcement, which character named Billy, who we'll learn more about and who become more pivotal as things go on, and work with like informants on the ground in these different communities. And these are like his ins to these worlds. And also, you know, hunters, for better or for worse, within monster communities, like you live outside the bounds. The social contract is you get to live in secret if you behave yourself. And if you become a problem, if you become violent, if you attack anybody, then we send a hunter. We don't even send the cops. We don't send anything. Like, we send hunters because there can be no justice. There can be no due process. And you can't go to prison because then you'll out all vampires or werewolves or whatever. And this whole thing goes out the window. So, like, monsters will also use hunters to police their own communities when people step out of line. It's not unheard of to have, like, a hunter-scared-straight situation, you know, with monsters who are posing a threat to the community or have done violent things or need to be taught a lesson. And sometimes, you know, monsters know to call a hunter in to do the business that they either can't or won't because of, you know, internal communal pressures and not being the guy who wants to like hold the bag at the end of that situation. So, you know, he does already see monsters as complicated people, and his innate sort of like sympathy and earnestness is like translates to like his attraction to Dorian, because it's like, you know, Dorian's just Dorian's Dorian. Dorian's his best friend. You know, they go in the car together and they hang out and they talk and they have a great time, and Dorian's the only one that understands him. So yes, he is a monster fucker. This is transition out of the love stuff. And in the context of their relationship, like, it is, yeah, Doran being a vampire is a huge part of his attraction, you know, the claws and the fangs and the eyes that reflect light, you know, like cat's eyes in the dark, you know, there's his reflexes, you know, his strength, his speed, his hissing at every, like, minor inconvenience, you know, the fact that he growls when he's mad about things. All of these things play into this, like, very bestial sort of, like, side of Doran that Cash is very attracted to. Sometimes to his own detriment, he can be a little handsy. And for him, it doesn't really cause any sort of conflict because he doesn't see, at least in his own head, like, he doesn't see monsters as other. He sees them as people, just a different kind of people. And he understands that he occupies a certain distance from them and he can move among them, but he's not necessarily to be trusted. He doesn't expect them to trust him either. So the fact that Doran trusts him so easily is like another, like, you know, little notch on the loving Cash for life thing. So, yeah, you know, he likes what he likes. He likes a little rough, likes claws, likes fangs, and it doesn't cause any sort of dissonance for him because Doran was a fully realized person already. I'm not sure if that makes sense to anyone but me. But that was sort of how I came to the whole sort of the crux of their relationship from Cash's side is that, like, you know, it is that sort of, like, bestial nature is exciting. It is very different. It's something, you know, it taps into that, like, little subby side of his brain that is like, yes, please wear the velvet cape and step on me. I love that Dracula shit. But yeah, like I said, I've had to cut back on some of his other monstrous romances in the past for the sake of brevity and making coherent sense of the plot. But yes, Cash is a confirmed monster fucker for life. The end. Forever.
Monster fucker for life. I love it.
Yes. This is like a me thing. I don't know if anyone else feels that way. But like, I know for me, it's the allure of like the boundary violation because a monster is something completely other than yourself. And obviously, like, the history of, like, myth and folklore and, like, literature and whatever, like, monsters and vampires and werewolves all represent different things, different social fears, different social ills, you know, vampire lesbians are coming for your virgins, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We're very used to that stuff. But I'm constantly fascinated by the idea of the boundary cross as, like, a monster as being representative, not as a rejected human or a cursed human, but like a representation and an extension of like the natural world, like an offshoot of humanity, like just a part of our world that we don't have access to, that has been hidden from us or that we have rejected in our own histories, you know, and that's something that we feel like a kinship with. It's like the rejected self, you know, it is part of nature, it is part of our world, but we've turned our back on it. And I love the idea of like the boundary cross with the monster and the human relationship. And the way that I like conceptualize it in my own work and the works that I respond really well to is that like I love the idea of like the monster desiring the human, but not as like a conquest or any of that stuff, because that's another thing, you know, that happens a lot. But just like the curiosity of something, of the human being an other to the monster. And that's why I have a lot of like monster protagonists. Like, you know, Doran is, you know, technically like the romantic lead of the series, you know, and, you know, he is, you know, it's most of it is, a lot of it is from his perspective. And so much of like his internal choices and feelings and thoughts about things are going to drive the plot of the series, you know. And I like the idea of a monster who is like a fully embodied subject, who is both like rejected, the rejected human self, obviously, as part of our world, part of nature. And I just think that, like, at least in my brain, like, I love the idea of a fully embodied monster who can straddle that line between the natural world and the human world and can make informed choices about whether or not to love the human. Because to me, yeah, the monster may have teeth and claws, but, like, there's always going to be fewer monsters than humans, you know, whether it's like a something stalking the countryside, stealing goats or virgins or whatever, or, you know, like an urban fantasy plotline like mine, where they are integrated into society to some extent or another. You know, their monsters will always be maligned. They will always be pushed to the margins. And like, what is that negotiation of power between the human and the monster? The monster is like the embodied subject, you know, and it's like, what does a monster gain from loving a human, you know? And it's sort of like that tension between, like, if a monster is representative of a queer person, the maligned person, the rejected person, whatever, you know, like, are you loving the human? Are you loving, are you becoming, are you trying to integrate or assimilate, or are you taking someone at the margins and creating something together, you know? And that's where I tend to go with my writing, is that, like, all of my characters in Southern Gothic, you know, Dorian and Cash, but also, like, my standalone short stories and stuff, is that, like, these are all people who are already on the margins, you know? These are already, you know, queer people on the margins, and these are queer monsters on the margins. And, like, do they try to join society, or do they turn their backs on it? And for me, it's like, it's that tension between, like, do you join society, or do you reject it as someone who's been rejected by it? And it plays into ideas of, like, ecology and religion and, like, dominant cultures and patriarchy and all that stuff. But it's like, to me, it's that tension between, I guess, of the different domains, you know, the natural world, the human world, what can be gained, what can be lost, you know, your own sense of self, your own integrity, should you choose to pursue a human relationship. And that's something that I personally get into a lot with Southern Gothic and with Dorian and Cash, is like how they precisely navigate those margins and who has power in those situations. Because even within their relationship, yes, Dorian could snap Cash in half, and he'd probably like it, but, you know, he could snap Cash in half if he wanted to. That's what he can do. But he's also totally disempowered at all times, because he can't navigate society on his own. He can't drive. He can't do any of these things. He can't go into the human world and expect to be treated fairly or with respect, or even, you know, with anything. You know, he's a monster. And Cash is always aware that he has a certain level of privilege over Dorian, because, you know, he can go into the vampire world and be respected as a hunter, but, you know, obviously Dorian can't come to the human world without, like, wearing a hat and wearing, you know, covering himself and hiding his identity. So it's that tension that's, to me, very true of just, like, being a person for, you know, in obviously not always, but in many ways, who is sort of relegated to a certain measure of marginalization. You know, I'm non-binary, my girlfriend is non-binary, we're in a lesbian relationship, however you want to conceive of those things, and that's always going to put us at a certain level of distance from everyone else. So for me, it's that constant negotiation with yourself, with the other person, with the world around you, and that sort of sense of, like, binary crossing, or boundary crossing, I mean, that always kind of keeps me coming back to monsters. And I don't know if that's how other people feel about it. I know that a lot of people, in a lot of, like, popular criticism, it's like, you know, you treated me like a monster, so I became the monster. I don't know if that's fine, if that's how you feel. Like, I always take monsters as, like, a natural state. So I don't really care about, like, whether society rejected them or not. It's just kind of like, well, Dorian exists, and vampires exist, and he exists as a vampire and will always exist as a vampire. And it, you know, he's unfortunately subject to rules that he didn't agree to. But like I said, I know that that's sort of, like, the popular consensus. For me, I'm just really interested in those, like, negotiations, I guess, and the different positions that you can occupy in that sort of dynamic. And yeah, that's me. So.
No, I think that's all amazing. And, you know, I've written a couple different articles about monster fucking and monsters and queerness and transness and where do we identify and not with monsters. And I think you really hit the nail on the head in terms of, in those romantic monster fucking scenarios, like, what are we playing with there? You gave me a lot to think about. I'm going to have to really, like, sit and, like, stare into the distance and go, yes, a lot. So thank you so much. I was wondering if you could just tell us about what's coming up for you.
In the immediate future, as of this recording, my next novella will be out on September 30th. It is a sapphic Medusa in the modern day sort of retelling, recontextualization, I guess, called In the Bedroom of Medusa. And that will be out, like I said, in September. I'm starting all the pre-orders now. It'll be available on Amazon and Kobo and Apple Books and wherever, you know, ebooks are sold. That's coming out very quickly. It's in production. I will hit all my deadlines, but, you know, every day is a new adventure in the production of that one. I am working on a fucky monster short story collection. I don't know. I don't have a title for that yet. It's going to cover various monsters and monster romances, both, you know, horror monsters, but also like mythological creatures and haunted houses and ghosts and minotaurs and werewolves and all sorts of things. I'm already working on that. I think, though untitled, I believe I want that out like next spring or summer. I am always working on the next Southern Gothic book, which is titled Black Diamond. I hope that that will be out in late 2022 or early 2023, depending on how production goes. But I'm always working on something, always cooking up some little monster fuckery for the good people of Earth.
Beautiful. We will obviously be retweeting. We'll link to your sites and everything else. But why don't you let people know where they can find you on social and where they can find you online?
All right. I'm always, always yelling on Twitter. You can find me at Megan Cubes. For more general book news, on Instagram is Megan Cubed as well. You can find my website, megancubed.net. And for news, original fiction, little behind-the-scenes stuff, personal writing, essays, criticism. You can also follow my newsletter, which is currently at Substack, but that is subject to change based on what Substack decides to do. But for now, you can always find my newsletter at makingcubed.substack.com.
Woohoo! Awesome.
I think that we were pretty rough and tumble with our questions on this one. We were like, all right, so what do you think about this societal issue that is sweeping?
We're like,
that
Megan,
you cannot be the only response for.
Megan, thank you for joining us. Here is the hardest thing I've ever thought about. Go.
Yeah, and I feel like we both kind of did that. So I have no further questions, Your Honor. but it's been really fun to talk to you all, and it's been super, super fun. Just to get a little bit of insight, I love following you on Twitter, and I've been really, really loving the newsletter. So I highly recommend that people sign up for that. Really specifically, we didn't get into it here, but there was this great Umbrella Academy article that was connected to a lot of these personal and sometimes traumatic events in your life. And I think it was one of the best pieces of criticism I've read in a really long time. And it kind of caught me by surprise because, as I mentioned before we started recording, I don't know that much about the Umbrella Academy. I believe I've read half of the comics, maybe, and it was like a while ago. But yeah, I mean, it made me be like, wow, it's kind of not even about that, right? And like, sometimes the best criticism is like that, where you're just like, ostensibly, it's about this comic, but also it's about so many other things around that and why it was so important. So I loved it, and I highly recommend.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That was a very long essay that I spent almost a year writing, I think, maybe 2 years. So yeah, I'm really glad that it has resonated with people. That was one of my most personal pieces of writing that I've ever put on the internet, besides that's basically the sequel to like my Hannibal essay, which is the exact same, let's talk about trauma and also a TV show kind of framework.
Right.
But yeah, I'm super glad that, you know, people responded to it, that it's meant something. So yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for reading it. Thank you so much for having me. I've had a blast talking about all the many complicated issues of society, and I'm glad to have the last word on all of it. So.
Perfect. Solved. What I'm saying is we solved it all. So no, Megan, you've been absolutely delightful. Thank you for making us think really hard. I'm going to, yeah, like I said, go stare into space for a while and go, oh my, that is a good point. So thank you for your time. Thank you for writing beautiful, beautiful queer characters that we can love with our whole hearts and souls. I'm so excited to dive deeper into your worlds that you're building. And yeah, Sarah, you're the best as always. Listeners, we couldn't be here without you. Of course, you know the joke, but I'm still going to say it. We could, but it'd be really awkward if we were. So thank you all so much. Kate, who's editing this, I love you. You're the best. Kyoko, who was meowing in the background, thank you for your efforts.
Oh, no. She ate. She's out. Oh. Don't worry. Like, I found like a box of cat food that I had like snuck under the table somehow. Like, and I just totally forgot about it. She came up and I was like, oh, you probably want food. So yeah, no, she's passed all the way out. So don't even bother saying anything to her. She is gone. Dead to the world right now.
Well, good night, Kyoko. We love you. Kyoko is Sarah's kitten, if you didn't know, listeners. Thank you all so much. Always a pleasure to be here with Bitches on Comics, and we'll catch you next time. Thank you for listening to Bitches on Comics. We are a bi-weekly podcast where we talk to your favorite comics and pop culture creators and critics about what matters to them in comics and pop culture, as you might have guessed. You can follow us on Twitter at @BitchesOnComics and on Instagram at @BitchesOnComics. Our website is, brace yourself, bitchesoncomics.com. If you go there, you can listen to any of our episodes, and we've got other shit that we put on tabs. I don't remember what it is. I am in charge of updating the website, however, so good luck.
Thanks for the heads up. I'll go to this website now.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm S.E. Fleenor, and you can learn more about me at sefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.